Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. Today we get the perspective of a peacemaker on two nations. First, Iran.
In 2003, President Khatami put out a grand proposal for a united peace agreement with the West, which would involve withdrawing support for Hamas and Hezbollah in exchange for some kind of reasonable peace settlement with the Palestinians and normalization of relationships with the United States. That was refused by the Bush administration. Then after that, dishonoring the Iranian hardliners, were able to critique Khatami and others who were wanting a more peaceful relationship with the West.
And then Syria.
Of the range of countries in the region that have experienced what has been called the Arab Spring, Syria was the country that had the least opportunity for its citizens to develop the capacity to relate to each other well and develop various forms of civil society.
I am delighted to welcome this week to Talk Nation Radio, Roy Hange. He is a Mennonite pastor here in Charlottesville, Virginia. He has spent 30 years studying the Middle East. He has spent 3 years living in Egypt, 6 in Syria, 1 in Iran. He has taught peace building at Eastern Mennonite University and at the University of Virginia. Roy Hange, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Good to be with you.
What kind of work have you done for all of these years in Syria and Egypt and Iran?
I've been working at education and peace building relationally in a range of settings, most recently in 1998 in Iran, as my wife and I were at the western side of the dialogue of civilizations that President Khatami called for. So we were the first non-Muslims to live long-term in Qom, Iran, and engage in high-level intercultural and interfaith relationships.
That's terrific. I know I've told you I want to talk about Syria primarily, but as we're on the subject of Iran, and Iran is again facing threats and hostility, and there is a supposed nuclear conflict underway, what are your thoughts on what can be done from this side and from the Iranian side to ease the tensions and get us out of this looming threat of war?
Having related on both sides of that conflict off and on over the last 10 years or so, I have a sense that there are deep divisions on both sides and within both countries, the United States and Iran, over how to perceive the nature of the conflict and how to position their governments in response to that conflict. In 2003, President Khatami put out a grand proposal for a peace agreement with the West, which would involve withdrawing support for Hamas and Hezbollah in exchange for some kind of reasonable peace settlement with the Palestinians and normalization of relationships with the United States. That was refused by the Bush administration. Then after that, dishonoring the Iranian hardliners, were able to critique Khatami and others who were wanting a more peaceful relationship with the West. And in our own situation here in the United States, there are various voices that almost parallel that split in Iran, arguing for more militant or more peaceful negotiated arrangements to end this conflict. I have also understood that Iran and the United States have a tremendous amount in common, and there's a significant appreciation in Iran for American people and the United States vision for democracy, but not necessarily its policies in the last number of years. And I would say the Americans I've known who visited Iran and have gotten to know Iranians find them very warm and hospitable. And one of the major elements of this tension is the historic traumas and resentments between the two nations that go back over 50 years.
What we were both at a dinner within the past year in New York City with the current president of Iran, and you spoke there about your trips to Iran and the value of making such trips and relationships. Talk a little bit about what you think can be gained from such exchanges on the personal level.
Many significant beginning points for the transformation of enmity between two nations start informally, as it did with ping-pong diplomacy and Nixon's visit to China, as a number of folks were relating to various figures behind the Iron Curtain before the fall of the Soviet Union and the transformation of those two very significant and world-threatening enmity constructs began very informally at the initiative of visionary political leaders on both sides of the divide. So one of the new understandings that Joe Montville, former State Department psychologist, has worked at is track two diplomacy, where citizens and others not directly engaged in the diplomatic community representing countries can bring about and establish relationships and affect change in ways that have significant implications in the future trajectory of relationships. So I have seen and continue to experience ways in which informal relationships like student exchanges, visits, delegations that go both directions have brought significant new understandings on both sides.
I find that very encouraging because it is something that people can work on. Briefly, when you say that we're dealing with historical traumas and resentments on both sides of this this so-called conflict, I say so-called because there's so much fiction involved in what the conflict is over. From the American point of view, I think people are familiar with the hostage crisis, and there's a new Hollywood movie focused on it. What are the traumas from the Iranian side?
The Iranians' first democratically elected government was brought down by a Western-organized, British-U.S.-organized coup in 1953, where the Mossadegh government was brought down, and the monarchy was restored. The Shah then was displaced by the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Anecdotally, on one of my trips to Iran in 2004, I asked some Iranian hosts this question that in a way played with the perception of that trauma. And the question was that I have profoundly criticized that CIA coup in 1953 and British organized coup, but asked Iranians to understand that that move was a part of the Cold War against Russia and the Soviet Union, and Iran was one of the pawns in that Cold War. And my question was, what if the United States had not been too close to Iran until 1979? Would the Soviet Union, would Russia have invaded Iran like it did Afghanistan? And could Iran today look like Afghanistan looks like today? And that question led to some interesting conversations where I attempted, and we attempted together, to say that our history together has not been ideal, but we have framed to re-understand our trauma through.
Very interesting. I've never heard that question posed before. Of course, there is the U.S. is not without blame for what happened in Afghanistan as well.
Yes.
We're speaking with Roy Hange, who is a Mennonite pastor here in Charlottesville, Virginia, who has spent a great many years in what we call the Middle East, looking at conflicts and their resolutions. What do you see happening in Syria? Because it seems that something that began largely nonviolently in Syria quickly became violent, and an opportunity may have been lost for the time being there.
I would offer two initial reflections, one with a more immediate sense, and that is that of the range of countries in the region that have experienced what has been called the Arab Spring, Syria was the country that had the least opportunity for its citizens to develop the capacity to relate to each other well and develop various forms of civil society. In Syria, it was illegal for any group of more than six persons who were not related by blood to meet together regularly or without permission. So most of the structures in society were very state-controlled. And when you have freedom movements and protests emerging in that kind of context, the people themselves have no resilient institutions through which more natural forms of organization can emerge, and the government has a highly, actually East German Stasi-trained security service to crack down on any organized movement. So unlike Egypt, where the Muslim Brotherhood had sworn off violence and engaged in a fairly nonviolent movement along with other organizations. In Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood leadership had been banished from the country, and it had been fairly significantly squashed and not well organized within Syria. So there were no national organizations in Syria to carry or hold an alternative civil and political process nonviolently, even though there were some initial movements that began that. It soon turned into a violent trajectory toward a civil war. Stepping one step back into the more historical frame of reference, what is happening in Syria now is reflective of a range of transitions across the region where the colonial British, French, and Italian powers had set up colonial governments, and then after they left those governments, usually left in place dictators or military regimes that controlled the country. And what we're now experiencing is the gradual shedding of those dictatorial or military regimes into quasi-democratic Islamist-controlled governments in a range of countries across North Africa. And there are beginning to be movements toward similar transitions in a number of countries in the central part of the Middle East, most specifically Syria at this point.
So I'm assuming it's safe to say that along with everybody else, you didn't predict what happened in Tunisia and Egypt last year in any kind of detail. But when you looked at those countries a year and a half ago, would you have seen something very different from what you saw in Syria in terms of the capacity for nonviolent movement that might result in a better civic society?
I was not surprised by the capacity of the Tunisians and the Egyptians to carry out the kind of transitions they did with significant internal leadership. There had been a significant movement of a range of organizations in those countries to develop alternative perspectives or visions for an alternative political future for their country. The challenge in places like Libya and Syria is, in its context, where you have a highly centralized government-controlled political, social, and cultural apparatus, there is very little capacity for change that is not initiated from the top. There's been no social muscles exercised or allowed to be exercised for the last series of decades, 40 or so years in those countries.
How might anyone from the outside, if at all, help to build such capacity? And what can we do at this point to prevent things becoming worse? I'm assuming that an all-out NATO engagement on behalf of Syrian opposition at this point would count as making things worse. I'm interested in your perspective.
I think the recent organization of a national coalition for Syrian revolutionary and opposition forces has provided a new focus for the opposition groups to invite the allegiance of what some have called the silent majority in Syria, who don't like the regime but don't like an uncertain future that some of the militias are pointing toward, which might be a bit more Salafist or Islamicist than many people would feel comfortable with. The reality is around 60% of Syria are Sunnis, but not many of them are for a more stringent conservative Salafist position. And of the 40% of others who range in a different sets of minority groups, many of those don't trust a very conservative Islamist trajectory that some of the opposition groups, foreign-funded opposition fighters, militias, are interested in. It's interesting that the Islamist militias in Aleppo recently spoke against the organization of the National Coalition. So the challenge in Syria is, coming back to my previous point, how to establish a national vision across a range of ethnic, political, and social orientation at a time where there's little possibility of communication even between cities and militias. So the challenge of the transition dynamic in the country is how to keep the country from descending into more more chaos and violent civil war.
Just to clarify, what is your position on the involvement thus far of other countries, including our own, the United States?
The countries most interested in what happens in Syria have divided themselves up into pretty much two camps: Russia, China, Iran, and non-aligned nations supporting a more status quo Syrian government-initiated potential transformation process. So Russia and China have used their veto in the Security Council to move against sanctions and other actions called for by the other side, which would be more United States, Europe, and Gulf Arab states, who would call for more of a robust movement against the Assad regime. My personal position is that in any society, the more nonviolent the transition, even though it needs to be more structured over time and might actually take longer, the better served that nation will be in the long term, because you are kept from moving into a kind of Balkans-like all-out civil war between ethnic groups where the status of trust in that context is held only by people who are just like us. And Syria has very much the potential to go there, and there's already significant sectarian violence happening. And the second caution I would have is that the more one gets into an intense civil war between various groups, the more trauma legacy there is that needs significant process afterwards. So it was somewhere in the spring of 2011 where that shift happened to a much more violent trajectory. And now you have a group, which is an al-Qaeda-affiliated group, Jabhat al-Nusra, carrying all out suicide bombings or other significant attacks, catalytic attacks, almost every three to 5 days in Syria. And this group is the one that was attributed to having stopped the Lakhdar Ibrahimi ceasefire at the time of the feast by carrying out a bombing that killed a significant number of Syrian forces. So the challenge is, even if you move toward a ceasefire, there will be those militant groups that will attempt to sabotage it for the sake of their own vision. So what's happening now in Syria is a disparate set of multiple visions for what Syria should be and different visions for how to get there. And I do hope this national coalition can begin to coordinate and unify the vision for some kind of transformation that is less violent than it is now.
I've heard you speak on this topic at an event here in Charlottesville, Roy, and you described the historical traumas and resentments and divisions among the different religious sects and religious groups and regional allegiances within Syria already, that prior to any additional conflict, that somehow need to be dealt with. Can you talk briefly about what the demographics of the society look like now, and how some of those past traumas might be dealt with if this new coalition is to move forward without becoming a tool for greater violence?
A former University of Virginia professor of psychology, Vemek Volkan, has described how chosen traumas, that is, how a group decides to define its present through windows from the past that are often traumatic, how chosen traumas affect our understandings of group identity and enmity. And for the Sunnis, who are about 60% in Syria now, they have a significant chosen trauma of having been put down by the Alawites, having the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood movement crushed, having tens of thousands killed in Hama in early 1980s. And the Alawites themselves, who are about a 10 to 12% minority group, who were put in power by the French colonial powers to control the majority minorities are easier to manipulate, as the British found in Iraq when they empowered the minority Sunni community there, and we found out what that meant post-2003. The Alawites themselves were persecuted severely by the Sunnis before they eventually emerged on top of the pile through the Assad family. The Alawites do not want to return to that former status of persecution. The Sunnis don't want more persecution, and the Kurds, who are about 2 million Syrians, have been not well treated over much of Syria's history, even at times denied significant identity status. They don't want to be relegated again in whatever new structure moves out, and there's some independence movements within various Kurdish factions. And then you have a collection of Christian, Druze, Circassian, and other Ismaili groups who have had persecution off and on as minorities. Over the years, the Christians faced a massacre in the 1860s, though the Christians have done fairly well under the Assad regime as it's been more secular, and they've been able to have more freedom than in most other countries in the Middle East.
And if we are to if we're to see some of these divisions reconciled and a movement go forward without further exacerbation and further violence and conflict, how in the best case scenario can you imagine that playing out?
Working at faith-based peace building for me is a process of restructuring the enmity content in various relationships at various levels. So I found it fascinating that the Syrian National Council, which was the former focus of the opposition before the November meetings in Qatar, decided to appoint a Christian as its head, a George Sabra, even though the Syrian National Council had been predominantly Muslim Brotherhood dominated. The more different groups can have face-to-face relationships with each other through their representatives to establish trust, the more that trust can go viral in various communities. So what I like to see in contexts like that is where occasions of what I call cognitive dissonance, that is the unexpected relationship, like George Sabra's heading up the Syrian National Council, can create perceptions or examples of how very different people can get along and work together. So folks in various places around Syria can imagine a different trajectory in their own relationships. That is, if George Sabra can get along with the Syrian National Council leadership, maybe I can get along with the co-religionists of the majority group in the Syrian National Council. For me, this is illustrated by how France and Germany reconciled after World War II, and the European Union just got a Nobel Peace Prize for that long trajectory of reconciling work that was begun in the late 40s and early 50s by Moral Rearmament, which is now morphed into a group called Initiatives of Change, where they actually work at restructuring relationships in various countries where conflict is dominant. So I'm not pessimistic in the long term, but in the short term, Syria is so divided and so controlled by various outside interests who have different visions for the future of Syria that the challenges are quite significant in the near term.
In the few minutes we have left, what do you make of U.S. foreign policy in relation to Syria? I of course, note the open comments by various members of our government that Syria's regime needs to be overthrown because of its allegiance to Iran, its alliance with Iran, and I find it very hard, of course, to take seriously claims of humanitarian motivation while Bahrain is ignored and Saudi Arabia is ignored and so forth. What do you think motivates the U.S. government, and what ought our policy, if any, to be? Maybe stay out is the answer, but what do you think the U.S. government should be doing here?
I think one of the prime motivations was a sense of caution moving up to the presidential elections in November. Now that major question has been answered, there's a bit more freedom, but my consistent advice and perspective is that radical or abrupt transitions or of power that involve the overthrow of governments often tend to be more chaotic in the long term, as in Libya and Iraq, 03, whereas more gradual transitions that work emotional and relational and social and political processes through incremental structures like in South Africa and the post-World War II reconciliation between France and Germany, when you have these incremental processes where peace is actually built gradually over time, you build structures that shape a different future for generations. I'm hoping that that somehow can start in Syria. I don't know where that's beginning yet, unless the National Council, the Syria National Coalition, is able to do that or begin that process. And I know there are some people coaching that kind of process, but it's not possible within Syria at this point, given the state of hostility.
It's not possible. It's a physical impossibility to move toward...
The militia groups can't even communicate with each other. Many of the communication networks are shut down. Travel between cities and towns is very difficult. Internet communications is being shut down in various cities. You can communicate through Tor and other groups, anonymous web conveyances, but it's still very difficult to do the significant relational work and organization between communities who now don't trust each other because of chants like Alawites to the Grave and Christians to Beirut that some of the Muslim militant groups have used both in Homs and Aleppo, and how some perceive that Al-Qaeda is active, and how others perceive that various countries like Iran are sending reinforcements. International players are active on various sides of this conflict in a way that breeds mistrust and creates an internal process in Syria that is highly, highly fractured. And that's my major concern. How one builds a new Syrian identity is no longer a Syrian question. It's an international question, because the major divide between the Middle East, whether it's going to be Sunni majority in Syria or a Shiite arc that runs from southern Lebanon to Syria, Alawite controlled, which are Shiite splinter group, to Iraq, which is Sunni Shiite controlled, which is Shiite controlled now, and to Iran, which is Shiite controlled. Whether you have that Shiite arc or a Sunni column down the middle of the Middle East is the main question at the regional level being fought over top of Syria at this point, between Turkey and the Gulf Arab states and Iran and Hezbollah and other Shiite Iraqi and Shiite states. So the challenge is not just a Syrian challenge anymore, and there is a real risk of Syria becoming a place where multiple levels of international conflict are played out.
So very, very difficult. I resist saying impossible, and less difficult as more people come to better understand the situation, for which this has been very, very helpful. Roy Hange, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
You're welcome.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. All past shows can be found at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christiane Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.